has a 3-month vacation. He's calling it his tour across America. If it's all the same to you, I'll drive that tanker. And now that I've completely butchered an Australian accent from an undisclosed secret bunker.
G'day, I'm Irk, and welcome to IrkPod episode 181. Of course, I am here in the United States, and you can check out my adventures on this podcast, IrkPod, and also my ambient noise podcast, Echo Romeo Kilo. And you can check them out at www.channelirk.com. And don't forget, you can email me as well, irkpod@gmail.com. Also, don't forget my other two shows, Blast from the Past and Irk FM. They are being pre-recorded. They were pre-recorded, as a matter of fact, when I was in Australia. And so I'm actually not recording any episodes of those two shows while I'm here. But today, in a very warm car, we have a special guest. And this interview basically came about because of my involvement with Irk FM. Would you like to introduce yourself, special guest?
Sure. I am Sez Julian, and we are in Oakland, California right now. And I have just released a new album in January called On to the Next that Irk got a hold of, and he liked one of the songs on it and played it and let me know of his travels. So when he hit town, I said, I am taking you out for some food and drinks, and here we are.
And that's exactly what we've done. We've just come out of Park Lane, which seems rather appropriate for some reason. It was an awesome dinner. Thank you.
My pleasure. It's good to put a face to the name.
Absolutely. Now, it was quite a few weeks ago that we actually played one of your songs, and we'll be playing that particular song at the end of this episode, so we can hear what Sez actually sounds like when she's singing and not necessarily just talking to us. So how do we find each other? That's an interesting one, and it's pretty much how I find a lot of musicians for Irk FM. This is actually the first artist interview that I've actually done, and we'll be having snippets of this on Irk FM. So how did we find each other?
I belong to a PR website that's sort of helping me get my music into the hands of people like you. So, and you belong to them on the other side of it. So they send it out to places that are willing to listen to and check out new music. And then if people like it, they'll get in touch with me and let me know that they are interested in some MP3s or whatever. And you got in touch. I guess that's how it happened.
And that's exactly what happened. So for all of my audience on IrkPod who haven't heard your song yet and they didn't hear what I said about you on Irk FM, why don't you take us back and tell us how you got into music to start with?
How I got into music. I started playing piano when I was 4 and took classical piano lessons and sort of had parents who had a mixture of sadism as well as encouragement. So I was forced to practice every day, which I'm very grateful for now. But so I played piano, and then I started playing classical viola. Kept practicing every day, an hour a day, and then taught myself guitar at 16, and that's kind of when I started switching over. So, I've been playing kind of my whole life in a variety of genres. I've played classical viola in many symphonies and, gigged in many bands on guitar, punk bands and blues bands and all sorts of stuff, and keep coming back to the solo stuff. So that's what this album is, all solo.
And so when did you decide that you wanted to be a musician, and rather than just play as a kid and then basically forget about it as you grow up and move into other things?
I don't know. I don't know that it's that simple, Irk, that you make a decision. For me, it's so integrated in my life that I think it is clear to me that music will always be a big part of it in whatever way it manifests. In some years it manifests in greater ways, and some years less. But when I did move to San Francisco from Philadelphia in 97, I came out here to make it in music, and I pushed really, really hard at it and was gigging all the time. When I didn't have gigs, I was playing open mics. When I wasn't playing open mics, I was busking in the streets in the Upper Haight and getting my demos in anyone's hands and everything else. And eventually, as often is the case, that didn't work out. And I didn't officially give up that dream, but I moved forward in other arenas of my life, and music perseveres. So I come back to it anyway.
And so with the way that things are, you can have a full-time job, which is something that you do, and you also do your music as well. So it's quite possible to do both and to have some success, and mainly the enjoyment as well, as which is what you were saying a bit earlier.
Right. Yeah, we were talking about this earlier at dinner when the recordings weren't rolling, but that there is a lot of similarity to your podcasting, or somebody who loves gardening or something. I mean, there are ways you can take it to, you know, 100 percentile level and spend all your free time on it and any variety in between. That's definitely true. And most certainly in the States, and I imagine this is probably true in most of Western civilization, if you're a musician who has not yet made it, it's very, very hard to make a living off it. So the odds are you are going to have another job, and it's going to be a full-time job, and it's just where you invest your other energies, I guess. Yeah, how passionate you are about maintaining that.
And that's the thing. You're not necessarily restricted because you haven't signed up with a big label. They don't own you, so you can go in whichever direction that you choose. And because you're multi-talented and multifaceted, you're not just pigeonholed into one way, into one genre, like some of these, say, pop princesses are. That's all they do. You can vary yourself according to whatever floats your boat, to use an Australianism.
We use that one here too. But yeah, also whatever the month or the year brings too, you know. But I have been working independently on an album with an electronica producer, and he gives me sort of these electronica sketches, and then I try to write songs or add a bass line to it, which is a totally different genre than I've ever experienced songwriting as, and is very challenging and a lot of fun. I'm not owned. I tour and gig when I feel like it. So with this album, I actually intentionally tried to write each song in a different genre, so because I wanted to challenge my musical capabilities but also keep it interesting, and because it's a solo album, it's me and whatever instruments I'm playing on it, and so that is sort of a unifying string on it anyway, that to have a country song followed by a blues song followed by a sort of madrigal song, it doesn't sound as jarring as it sounds because it's all me. So that was actually really fun to be able to do whatever I wanted.
So that would be one advantage of that. And so, as you just said, you can go in whichever direction that you want. It's probably a bit of a self-discovery journey as well, according to where you are when you write the songs. Now, I've interviewed authors before, but as I said, this is the first time that I've interviewed a singer-songwriter. And so, how do you get your inspiration for your songs?
For me, they come from life and often from relationships, which I think is pretty much true for a lot of art in general, not just music and certainly not just singer-songwriter. But, my songwriting process usually comes from a bass line that I like. It doesn't start with a lyric. A bass line that might develop into a more intentional genre, that develops into a riff, that develops into perhaps a chorus or a verse. And then from there, I usually start scatting until I find some melodic lines that I like. And honestly, at that point, I usually start spitting out some words that I didn't know were in my head. And if I hit a phrase that I like, that's where I start. And then I start focusing on the lyrics. So just one chick's interpretation of writing a song, as any author would tell you too. But I'm not the type of person that wakes up in the middle of the night. I do write songs in my dreams, but I cannot remember them, and they could very well be absolutely horrid. So I don't know. But yeah, it's like any art. I think it's varied depending on the day, the month, the person, the era.
So do you carry around like a notebook or something like that to write down your ideas?
Not at all, but because I work from home and I am, you know, my job is computer oriented, I'm not often in positions, you know, where I can't access paper, but it's not, for me, the process is very intentional. And this whole album was, I set deadlines for myself and said I'm going to write 12 songs in 12 weeks. And that was, you know, I'd spend several nights a week working on one song and then move on to the next. So it was more like setting aside work hours, just like when you probably set aside your podcast
yep.
hours. And though you might have ideas in your head, and I don't know if you have a pocket filled with like little notes that you've been making,
no,
all the time,
not usually,
or if they're all, you know, just sort of a few general concepts in your head or whatever. But yeah, for me, it was a very intentional sort of a work space that I would set aside to make it happen.
And so you're not only writing the songs, you're also writing the music
mm-hmm.
to go with it as well.
Right. I'm playing all the instruments. Yeah. On this album I play, there's my acoustic, a Guild, my electric guitar, which is a Stratocaster, electric bass on a couple of the songs, which is a Fender. I have one song on the auto harp. Two of the songs I play viola on as a backup. And then I think there's one or two songs that have backing vocals as well, but yeah, it's all me. It's all me playing around with my pile of instruments.
So you're not playing with all these instruments at the same time?
No. Although most of the tracks on this album were done as live takes, so for the most part, they are me playing guitar and singing at the same time. For example, the song you played on your podcast, "Cat Suit," was a live take of me playing the electric guitar and singing at the same time, which doesn't work for everybody, but in my experience, when I record them separately, both the guitar and the vocals feel a little flatter and a little more just architected in a way that isn't really human. So that's what works for me. But no, then I can't, unfortunately, when I gig, you know, play the viola at the same time I'm playing the auto harp and the bass. So
I was just getting a mental picture when you said that you'd been busking before. I just sort of got the whole one-man band sort
right.
of deal.
Yeah. No, when I busk, it was just the acoustic guitar. Although, you know, in the Upper Haight, and I don't know if you got a chance to spend any time up there, but
no.
The Haight-Ashbury area of San Francisco is sort of known as a pretty big, you know, history of hippie and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, and it's still perseveres with a lot of homeless youth, and so there was always people wandering around with nothing to do, these kids and their dogs with, you know, didgeridoos and like tambourines
yeah.
and stuff, so it was pretty easy to make a band on the spot, but I wouldn't say it was ever any good. Glad I don't have any of those recordings.
So talk us through the album. You said that you dedicated some time each time to write a song.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any one thing, apart from you playing all the instruments and you doing all the singing, that even though you've got different genres, sort of shines through as like a common theme?
Well, I think, you know, the sort of the blues voice, I think, does persevere regardless of the songs. And certainly putting on my cat suit, the song that you chose, has a bit more of a blues influence to it. Yeah, that's something that's sort of really a natural heartfelt way to play with notes in music that isn't so metered and strict and done the same way every time is probably the musical tie, and of course the conceptual tie or the emotional tie is, you know, this album There's probably about two major relationships that sort of occurred within pretty close to the time frame. So you always have that excellent fodder. Yeah. But, yeah, the two of them together. Bring the blues, right?
Yep.
give me more.
And so the song that we'll be playing at the end of the episode, you better give it its full title.
Yeah, it's called Putting On My Catsuit. Putting On My Catsuit.
and of course, I played that a few weeks ago on Irk FM, and I found it to be an earworm. Was that the intention?
You found it to be what?
An earworm. One of those songs that you can't get out of your head.
No, but every musician loves to hear that. No, I didn't write any of it as being intentionally hooky, although if it sticks with you, I mean, that's one of the bigger compliments you can pay us. So that's great to hear. Thank you.
So what was the story behind that particular song?
I think it's a bit of a backlash song. It's sort of like inability to connect with people and just sort of saying, you know, fuck it, I'm going out. And I mean, the first refrain is just sort of, I'm putting on my cat suit and going on a bender. Because my songs aren't always sweet, and my love's not tender. Sort of, screw you, I'm going out and having a good time, and I'm not going to sit around and cry about this. So, once again, I don't think that was the intention of where I started on the song, but that's where it landed, so I can't deny it.
So you were quite happy with the way that it turned out?
I think for the most part, yeah. I am pleased with it as a group of songs. I think that something that any artist feels, but also this is probably true in anything we try to do. Once again, with your podcast or somebody, you know, planting flowers or whatever, you can put a vast amount of effort into getting something to maybe 85% quality. And then you can put double that effort into getting it to 95% quality. And then you can spend the rest of your life getting it to 99%, you know? So, you know, I tried to make this as great as I can, but I still listen to it and can find faults left and right with it and ways I do things better. But I think perfection is sort of in our head and an unattainable situation. So I am overall very pleased with it.
But having said that, there's nothing worse than hearing a CD and then going to the live act and they sound nothing alike.
That's definitely true. And that's. I mean, we didn't use any auto-tuning or anything in the studio. And like I said, a lot of these were single takes. A lot of these were me playing. So, this isn't... this is quite the opposite of that. This is just real. This is pretty much exactly what I sound like on stage or in my living room. But, on live... I mean, I have one live album that I've done that I really like because... I was very well rehearsed and very prepared for the gig, but it was also very in the moment. And so, you know, you could go into the studio and never achieve perfection that you're supposed to achieve. But on stage, you just do as awesomely as you can, and you can practically get to the same place.
So what was it like the first time that you saw the completed product with the CD and everything like that?
That's a good question, Eric. I was kind of anticlimactic. I expected it to be a little more, but I think for me the real climax was when we actually finished it and I had the master of the album in my hand. That was sort of the pinnacle of the adrenaline rush and the achievement. And when I had it in my hand, it was just. It was just in my hand. Yeah. I don't know. It didn't get any further than that.
There wasn't just a massive, like a drum roll and here it is.
No, I totally expected that. I expected it to be something sort of monumental and perhaps that's why it wasn't. I don't know. But it's, I'm pleased with it though, so.
So where do you go from here? You've put this particular album out. Where to from here?
Yeah, I was mentioning to you earlier that I'm sort of taking a break from songwriting and even a break from my songs and just have been playing a lot of classical piano in the last 2 months, which is sort of a recalibration, I think, for me. But my the guy who produced my album, J.D. Moyer, who is also the one I've been working on, that sort of electronica duo that we're called Good at Human. And I think we're gonna start working on some more sketches in that realm. He does, he has a successful electronica label and electronica music, so he's always game. But something a little different. I don't know. I don't know if I'll put out another solo album for a while or what. But just keep making music in some capacity for sure. I'm gigging.
So you've got this particular album out, and you also said you've got a live CD that you were proud of as well. Have mm-hmm. you got anything else out apart from that?
Well, I have there was a first album I put out that was a studio album, but that was really self-produced and limited quantity kind of thing. And there are 12 original songs on that I don't perform anymore, that I have the recordings of buried in secret MP3 places on my website, but yeah, again, I'll send you one, Eric, if you promise never to put it on the air. Yeah, I'm just really sick of those songs. I'm pleased with the quality of that too. I gigged with those songs so many times. I just don't ever want to hear them again. So. So there's the three albums in total, the two studio albums and the live. But this is certainly the biggest one for me in terms of venture, in terms of reaching out to PR companies like the people that you work with, and getting people in the podcasts around the world to hear it. It's super exciting for me.
So let's talk a bit about that. Now, many of my listeners know the sort of process that I go through in trying to find music to play on IRC FM, and prior to IRC FM, I used to play the occasional song here on IRCpod, but the main reason I started IRC FM was because there was all these songs out there, and I thought they needed a dedicated place of their own. And so I'll go through my music partners and I'll listen to the music, and if I don't like it, they don't get on the show. If I can't find out the information easily about the artist, they don't get on the show. So from your point of view, what are you doing to get your music out there? How does it get from you to me?
This is, again, a little bit of what we were talking about earlier. First of all, before I even answer that, I just want to say that I think you have made an amazing commitment to doing this, that you're actually going out and finding these sort of indie music that isn't getting the airplay and doesn't have the, you know, big machine backing, that it's an extraordinary amount of work for you to sift through all the things that these PR people are sending you to find me, and then to decide whether or not you like it and play it. So, I'm so grateful for you and the people like you doing that, because that's a lot of work. And on my end, yes, I have the websites and try to get, you know, my bio and I did my photo shoot for this album and get, you know, the whole press kit and the photos and everything like that up, and then doing as much promotion as I can around it through companies like where you found me, but certainly being responsive to anybody that possibly has an interest in trying to get as much information out there as we can, so they don't have to contact me for anything, that they can find it right away. They're welcome to contact me, but
because that's the thing that we were talking about a bit earlier, in relation to bands that only have their main source of presence on MySpace, or you have to email them to play the songs, and I can understand that because that's a different kettle of fish, but even things like having to email them to find out something about them instead of having an About Me page. Usually if I have to go to that much effort, I'll just move on to something else.
Yeah, no, I mean, MySpace is a vehicle for getting music out to potential listeners who aren't necessarily interested in the full picture, and it's a very popular way to do that, but it's not, it doesn't offer you the same path to getting the accurate information out that people actually need in the professional environment, which is the press release and the bio and the photos and how to obtain a CD and how to contact them and it's a different perspective entirely, really. So of course you need a MySpace page. that's imperative as well.
That's where a lot of people are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'd recommend that they get a site up and take a look around at some of the what the PR. I mean, there's tons of free articles online about how to do your best personal public relations, how to write a press release about your new albums, or about upcoming gigs and all of that. But yeah, you need to take it a step further for sure.
And that's what you've done. I didn't have to necessarily ask you, you know, what's your website address, you know, anything about you. It was all there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was all there on your website, and it was up to me what I chose to highlight. And that's one thing that I do on IRC FM. I try and tell you or tell the listeners a little bit about the artist, because we've got the time to do it, and Joe Blow doesn't know you. And they should get to know you a little bit, you know, where you were coming from, or, you know, who you sound like, or whatever. And some people don't even do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And once again, this comes back to the point that I was making about you actually making a commitment to find out if you like the music, get the information about the artist, and then, you know, properly set them up on your show, which is... I think it's sort of the height of what somebody could hope for. I think it's just an extraordinary amount of work again. So, thanks, Eric.
That's all right. So, have you had much feedback from either fans of yours? Do you have like any groupies?
Yeah.
Apart from me.
It's funny. Yeah, a lot of the groupies, the people that will consistently come to gigs or whatever, are certainly part of a bigger sort of acquaintanceship or friends of friends, and music fans. Feedback beyond that is really just the amount of people that have checked out my music through the PR firm, I'm really pleased to even be, like, right now I'm in about 35 college radio stations across the country, in Oberlin and Hampshire and IRIT, and down in Nashville and even Texas. I can't even believe Texas would like me, but yeah, so the bulk of the feedback, or the most rewarding feedback, is the podcasts and the college stations that are actually being responsive to the music, which is just thrilling and I'm really grateful for.
So as a musician, as a songwriter, how are we looking here in America specifically in relation to radio, for instance, compared to podcasting?
Yeah, well, podcasting will certainly blow it out of the water, just like college radio did at one time. And I still, I mean, we have, for example, in the Bay Area, several great independent radio stations, the KUSF and Calex, Berkeley, which are the two that I listen to the most. But, you know, I was a college DJ in Philadelphia, and I was saying to you earlier, we just used to get tons of CDs in, you know, from tons of people we'd never heard of, and you'd try to go through as many as you could to see if you could find new things. And that's how I discovered at the time Morcheeba and Ben Harper and a lot of people that I still listen to now who were just getting their start then. But Morcheeba and Ben Harper were coming to me through through labels like BMI. You know, they were still not people like me. So the podcast, when the internet radio and the streaming internet radio is allows people like you to create whatever restrictions, rules, quality, raise the bar, create new format, that is explosive. I mean, in the United States, I think it's currently it's kind of insidious. It's you don't know how many people are listening and how many more people will be listening next week and how many new podcasts are going to show up next month. But yeah, just like everything else on the internet, it's certainly not to be underestimated.
Absolutely.
And we all see the value in that. Just like, you know, MySpace wasn't to be. So it's a continued revolution. I mean, I don't even know if you can use the word revolution because it's there's so much constant change that it's not like a moment in time. But
Do you think that a lot of musicians understand podcasting? Do you think they really get what we're trying to do?
Well, That's a complicated question, probably. I think in theory they do. I don't think that the full effect or impact is probably understood yet. I think that for the most part there's an understanding of sort of the streaming internet radio, and we were talking about sort of the stuff that comes through iTunes, but also whatever, Pandora or Live 365, streaming radio stations, but that the quality of podcasts aren't quite understood of where they fit into the picture. But it's certainly, I mean, I live in the Bay Area, so it's not a new term. It's been thrown around here for a long time, and it's common lingo now. But I think that I mean, you are in the on the sort of cutting edge of possibility for what's going to happen with this sort of oral experience. So in 5 years, it'll be a little late for them to catch on.
Because at the moment, we already have people who have come through the first original wave of podcasting 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. I'm probably on the second wave, and some of the people on the first wave are trying to distance themselves by not calling them podcasts. For instance, they might call them netcasts or something like that. So I think there's going to be a few different waves. I've been doing this for something like 2 years, and I know there's been quite a few people who have been doing this for a lot longer than I, but it's good to see that someone from a musical from the musical side of fence of the fence, and just to see the differences and what's different and what's the same, and are we doing you a service or whatever. And
You
from
guys.
my point of view, well, yeah.
Yeah, you're doing a huge service. Absolutely. It's a lot of work for you. So, yeah, but I was mentioning this to you earlier tonight that I think there is a lot of similarity that can be drawn from the rise of the blog and the blog community, and when it was small and a bit of an eccentric situation, and then when it grew really huge, and then suddenly when everybody had a blog and the original blogger started dropping off because of blogging wasn't the same anymore, and what it meant to get written up in a blog when it first started versus what it means to get written up in, Joe Schmo's blog now. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, of course, you're doing musicians a great service by doing what you're doing, finding these musicians that would never get played. And that's just one possibility of what you can do with podcasting. As you have all four of yours, and they do a variety of things. So, but you're doing what you want, and it's a great service to the independent musician, absolutely.
And it certainly has had some of its benefits. I probably wouldn't be sitting here right now, as a matter of
Absolutely
fact,
right.
if it wasn't for the podcast. So it'll be quite interesting to see how it goes and how it develops. We've shared a bit of information over dinner, sort of thing, to possibly help you along as well. And have you actually had a podcast interview or had any interviews before?
I haven't done an interview in a long time. I was on KLX Berkeley several years ago. They did about a 20-minute interview with me. I think it was when my live album came out. So it was probably about 5 or 6 years ago that and that was a college radio station that you would hear on the radio. So no, I've never done podcasts before.
Well, who knows, all you music podcasters? I hope you're all listening. You never know, and I've also sent you in the direction of the Association of Music Podcasting, which would be a great benefit to you as well. So who knows? We'll have to keep an eye on you.
Yeah, not just me, but just a huge thanks to everybody out there who's doing what IRC does. And if it's not my music that you're playing and it's someone else's, I'm just equally grateful that you're playing it.
Yeah, there's a few of us out there, and there's a few people in the same sort of boat that you're in. Hopefully, we'll be able to talk to a few more as we cross the country
Yeah, lined
from
up.
lined up. So, before we talk a bit about San Francisco, which is where we are now, why don't you tell people how to get your album and how to find out more about you.
Sure, yeah, you can visit sezg.com. That's S as in Sam, E as in elephant, Z as in zebra, G as in George, .com. That has links to my MySpace, that has MP3 downloads and links to the PR and everything else that we talked about earlier. All the information you could ever want, as well as links to all the people who have been playing me, like links to IRC and the college radio stations and the other podcasts. So, yeah, check it out.
You're definitely an example of someone who's doing it right. There's been so many people that aren't necessarily doing it right, because while I'm continually learning things as a podcaster over the last couple of years, all you basically want to do is put your music out. A lot of musicians probably don't realize that you have to spend time on your PR, time on your website, time on social networking. Some bands get it and some bands don't.
Yeah, I mean, my ultimate goal, of course, is to get somebody to listen to the song and perhaps enjoy it or feel something or agree with it or get angry, or I don't know, but just to listen to it. But yeah, absolutely, to get there. Yeah, well, once again, I'm in the Bay Area, which is, it's just a big internet breeding ground, so to not have a website is, it's just second nature for us out here.
So if there was a person from a big record label outside the car now, and he wanted to get you to sign on the dotted line, that's probably an amazing thought, but you must have thought about that.
Yeah, I would have. I wouldn't have batted an eye several years ago, but I would not sign at the moment. And if that said, I didn't get, you know, if I couldn't take some time to think about it and look at what was actually happening, then I would say no. I'm not. I want to keep making my music as I make it, and moving forward in my life in a positive way. And I don't want to, you know, become some little harlot for the music industry that passes through in 6 months. So, yeah,
no, that's
not my plan.
That's really awesome. So while we're here and while we're recording, why don't you tell us a bit about where we are now? I'm in San Francisco, of course, and this is the first IRCpod episode that I've recorded from here. I have recorded a couple of the Ambient Noise podcast, Echo Romeo Kilo. I recorded episode 41 at a protest and Echo 42 at various bits of the public transport system. But why don't you tell us a little bit about San Francisco from your point of view?
Well, I was an East Coaster, so I moved here in 97, and the mood is very different. The people are very different. I mean, it was almost as much of a culture shock as it is, I'm sure, for you to be out here visiting. because the East Coast, as you'll see when you're out there, is even more of that go-getter that you're talking about, that these people seem very laid back to me. So, but I love San Francisco. I think there's just an incredible arts community, culinary community. It's the city itself is only 6 miles by 8 miles. It's very small because it's on waterlocked in three sides. And then, you know, you have the suburbs in the South Bay down by San Jose and Silicon Valley. And then the East Bay, where we are actually in Oakland, that sprawl out. But the city itself is just this beautiful hills, little hillsides, little neighborhoods, so much different culture and flavor and so many different kinds of people. I mean, you can probably hear me smiling because I'm telling the story because I'm just in love with it. So it consistently enchants me. And my favorite thing about San Francisco is looking at, you know, and you could pretty much see this from anywhere in the city, seeing a little hillside at dusk when this sky is like that electric blue and the lights are just coming on and all the little hills and little houses. And you can just turn around 180 degrees and see it, see it in every direction. It's just, it's beautiful. It's just like a, you know, not a real place.
So needless to say, I've only been here since Friday afternoon. It's now Sunday night as we record this. and I'm leaving for Reno tomorrow. So needless to say, I couldn't have fitted in everything that there is to see. I sort of had some sort of impression, all the touristy sort of things that you get the impression of, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge and the cable cars and
Court Tower.
And everything like that. You sort of get this vision, but I could be here for a lot longer and probably still not see everything. Where are some of the places that you'd say, if you come to San Francisco, where would you take someone from out of town?
Well, you do have to see the Golden Gate Bridge and the Court Tower and everything else. I mean, it's like going to Sydney and you have to see the Opera House, you know, and see the harbors. But the Mission District of San Francisco, which is sort of in the southern area of San Francisco, it is sort of a cross between a Mexican neighborhood and a sort of a young urban hipster neighborhood. It's not sort of big money, old money. It's real people, a lot of bikes, a lot of cool bookstores and cafes and interesting bars and just markets and people. And I lived there for a couple of years and it's my favorite neighborhood. So it's not a real tourist destination. It's just a endlessly fascinating place to walk around. So I'd say the Mission District is number one.
Do you ever get used to the hills?
Well, it's not a real, there are ways to ride your bike and bike riders certainly know the best way to avoid the altitude, but, I guess you do get used to the hills. I mean, I'm very good at walking downhill, you know, just sort of like letting my body relax as I'm taking each step. So I do think you learn that to a degree, but, you also learn your way around the hills, which is, I suppose, the inner circle trick.
And speaking of hills, I went down probably the most strangest street that I've ever been down.
Lombard Street.
Lombard Street. Yeah. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Well, the story is it's the crookedest street. I don't know how tall tale it's gotten. It's the crookedest street in the city, in the state, in the country, in the world. I don't know what they told you, but it really does wind back and forth like a snake down a hill. You know, as the crow flies, that it's probably what, a quarter of a mile down the hill, but the road itself is probably like 2 miles because it snakes back and forth. And it looks like an amusement park ride for cars, but it's a bit scary to drive down. As I was telling Eric earlier, sometimes you get cornered into driving down it because some of the hills just drop off and you can't just, the streets end because the hill is just not going to work it out. But it's a lot of fun to watch those cars all scared and freaking out and driving down the hills.
Yes, I actually didn't know about that particular area of Lombard Street. And they had some of these tourist DVDs playing Windows and then I saw this street and I thought, oh yeah, that looks pretty cool. I'll have to check that out. And David, who was one of my hosts in Monterey, actually said to me this morning, go and check that out and check out the Coit Tower as well. So I got up the Coit this afternoon and also went down Lombard Street. I actually approached it from the bottom. And so I took a photo through my window because I didn't want to find a parking space and then get out and do all that sort of stuff. And then I went around and came down it. And it's strange to think that there's actually people who have their driveways
it's on true. There. It's like having, you know, your house on an amusement park road. But the bottom is the better place to approach it from. So you were right on. You were lucky with that one.
And so it was funny. Think of it as like a slalom ride down a ski slope, but instead of snow, you've got these hedges which basically tell you how to get down there. And then there's all these signs down it which basically say, do not hit the walls.
They've done, I know they do, I don't know specifically which ones are when. In the last couple of years, I know there have been like, there was a big wheel rally that went down it, you know, the big wheel, like the little tiny, like plastic bicycle, tricycle things that, so, you know, you have a bunch of big wheels doing it. I think there was, 2 years ago, there was some sort of skiing thing they did where they like had a bunch of snow machines on and brought the people snow. There might have been some sort of like slip and slide things set up or some water slide. I mean, they have been taking advantage of the possibilities of this road for, you know, for, I don't know, fun or press or financial gain or whatever it is. But, yeah.
I just couldn't believe the amount of people that were just standing there watching all these cars just basically drive down a straight, albeit very crooked.
Yeah, it's because it's a famous tourist destination. I mean, it's the same thing with the amount of people that want to take the cable car, and they're essentially taking public transit, you know. But it's very exciting because it's what you're supposed to do, so.
Yes, I did see the cable car. It was probably about an hour or so to get onto it, so I didn't actually get on it. I did go on the streetcars, and they were... That were quite
same
cool.
Idea. Yeah, yeah. Same idea.
same idea. So where else would you suggest, or where are some of your other favorite spots?
Well, I mean, it depends on the type of person you are. Certainly, the Castro is the country and possibly the world's biggest gay population. So that's, you know, like Halloween, it has this enormous parties and, you know, pride and all that, which is, it's very integrated into the city. So, you know, whether you're going to see it as a spectacle or that just it's something you support and are comfortable with. The Upper Haight, as I was saying earlier, which is the Haight-Ashbury, where I used to busk on the weekends, that's the sort of... bit more of a hippie area. Golden Gate Park is beautiful. It's the equivalent of our Central Park. So there's a Japanese tea garden, and there's all sorts of botanical forests and all sorts of cool stuff. And, of course, you can't miss the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh, yeah, you can't miss that. I didn't walk across it. I drove across it a couple of times.
That's pretty good. Yeah, that's just as good. Driving across it is kind of momentous.
It is. I just couldn't believe that, and also the Bay Bridge as well. Mm. That they are massive. I know you've seen Sydney as well, and those bridges are massive compared to ours.
Right. Well, but you guys have that incredible harbour system with all the different ferries that go everywhere. You know, our ferries are kind of a joke. So, and in exchange, we have bridges.
And of course, you have been to Australia, and that's one of the things that you initially said in one of your emails to me when you found out that I was indeed Australian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was about 2 years ago, just in southern and southeastern Australia, so I don't pretend to know the country and everything there is to offer, but spent some time in Sydney and some Melbourne and Adelaide, and drove around the Central Coast and was just really thrilled with the people and... the terrain and the cities. The urban planning in Adelaide just kind of floored me with the donut shaped park that keeps the whole city. I mean, it's really cool. I tell people about it all the time. And Melbourne, the artistic nature of the entire city, loved it. And Sydney, of course, is just mind blowing with once again all the different neighborhoods. I didn't even get to see half of it, I'm sure. So I'd be asking you the same questions if I were sitting out there.
Next time you come out, you were saying that you don't have as much, or in a normal job, you don't get as much leave as what we get. But the next time you're over, well, you know, feel free and I'll return the favor.
Yes, definitely. I don't know when I'll be back, because we only get, you know, about two weeks off a year. So, but... Yeah, I'm definitely glad I went. I'd recommend it to anybody, and I continue to.
And of course, you were saying that you had the similar sort of experiences with driving on the other side of the road that I did.
So funny! I was telling you earlier that it really makes me laugh years later every time I think about the stress of turning left or right and trying to figure out what you're trying to do based on, you know, the new rules. And then turning on the windshield wiper when you go to put on the blinker. I mean, every time it's like, you know, I'm like a child. I can't, that joke never gets old to me. So I hope as you reach that sort of that stress level where you go to put on the blinker and the windshield wiper comes on and the rest of this trip, that you have a good laugh at it, because it's the gift that keeps on giving.
So do you have any more tips? As I'm only on the West Coast and I haven't even left California yet. That's tomorrow. Any other tips or suggestions before we say goodnight?
Tips or suggestions for what, your travels?
Yeah.
For the world?
Yeah.
Be careful. Be careful, you know. Yeah, there's all kinds of people. And I don't need to tell you, you're an adult and you've certainly experienced them all. But it seems like you have a really good network of podcasters and friends through the internet that you're going to be hooking up with. So you're not out there alone. And I hope you have a great time. I'm excited for you. I'm going to live vicariously through you for the next couple.
Excellent. Awesome. So before I go, just like to remind everyone to check out channelerk.com. You can find a travel blog or a travel diary, if you like, of my trip each day. And there's not quite millions, but approaching millions of photos on Flickr. You can find out all the previous podcasts that I have done while I've been here. You can find out where I'm basically planning to go. Next stop, Reno. And you can find out all that. www.channelerk.com is the place to go for that. And I think there's only one other thing for us to do. And says, feel free to introduce Catsuit for us.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Erk, for taking the time to talk to me, and you and all your listeners and the other podcasters for supporting independent musicians. So now you're going to hear Putting on My Cat Suit by me, Sez Julian, at SEZG.com, from my new album, On to the Next. So this says goodbye to the contact sheet of memory, to tiny blurring images that skew and fade like everything so strange when I am waking. My ribcage cold before I know I step into my body. Autofocus and go ho ho. Now I'm putting on my cat suit and I'm going on a bender, 'cause my songs aren't always sweet and my love's not tender. The lighting's been dramatic and the portrait is evocative, but the picture I keep taking is turning more and more sullen, so strange when I am sleeping. My hands are warm, my heart makes room, I step up to your body. Auto zoom, now I'm putting on my flight suit without posing as repenter, 'cause my songs aren't always sweet and my love's not tender. Say, hey, tomorrow will be better. Lay me down, I seem to be untethered. Days are impossible to conquer, and the nights are even longer. I keep seeing flashbulbs from the corner of my eye. I can't imagine what's worth taking under this filthy sky, so strange when I am silent. The noiseless roars are deafening. I step into my song and sing. Now I'm putting on my armor without posing as repenter, 'cause my songs aren't always sweet and my love's not tender. Say, hey, tomorrow will be better. Lay me down, I seem to be untethered. Days are impossible to conquer, and the nights are even longer.
You are listening to Erk's Tour Across America. You are listening to Irk's Tour Across America.